I'd like to call the hearing of the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs Committee to order, please, and let the record reflect that it is about 5 minutes after 1 on February the 13th, 2007. And let the record also reflect that we do have a quorum, and who we have present at this time is Representative Kawasaki, Representative Ledoux, Representative Book, Representative Dahlstrom, and myself, Chair Representative Roses. I will put it also on the record that Representative Faircloth is, had a conflict and is in another meeting at the moment. She does plan on leaving that meeting after a very brief overview and then attend this meeting before we get to the completion of the overview and then the discussion of the bills that we have before us. So we will go from that point. And if anybody else shows up, then I will read it into the record. So today's schedule, as I've already indicated, is that we're going to start with an overview of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We will then go for a, to look at House Bill 45, which is the State Veterans Cemetery and the fund for that, and then House Bill 62, which is a tuition waiver for the National Guard families. So that is what we have on our agenda for today. So with that, I would like to invite General Campbell to come forward and give us an overview of what's going on with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And for those of you that don't know or haven't met General Campbell, he is the Adjutant General for the National Guard and took that capacity in 2003 and is continuing that capacity today. He's also the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. That took place again in 2003 and continues today. And there's a long list of accomplishments that General Campbell has had in public life as well as in municipal government. I won't go into all of those, but I think it's fairly safe to say that his background has placed him well for the service that he's provided to this, and I wanted to start by thanking him for the service he's provided in the past and look forward to the great service he's going to provide us in the future. So with that, the floor is yours, sir.
Well, Chairman Roses, thank you very much. And for the record, I am Craig Campbell, the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard, both Army and Air. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I appreciate that introduction, although you didn't have to do that. I represent a department of about 4,400 dedicated Alaskans, National Guard, Emergency Management, Homeland Security, Veterans, Youth Academy, Administrative Services, the list goes on. And I'm just proud to be able to be the leader of that department, and I think we're doing some phenomenal things. Before I get started with my overview, I've placed in front of your chairs our annual report for 2006, and I know some of you had it before, but I'm providing it just in case you want to reference it today during any of the discussion. And also our current Warrior magazine that is the winter edition has all its current stories of things that have happened in the department over the last 90 to 120 days. Also for the record, Mr. Chairman, those publications are published at no cost to the state of Alaska or to the federal government. We have an agreement with a publishing company where we provide the content, pictures, and all editorial and news articles, and they publish it. They sell advertisement that covers the cost, and we get $5,000 delivered each quarter. It's an outstanding, it's won an article, it's a magazine, it's won awards in the past, and I hope that you'll have the chance, as I mail it to you on a quarterly basis, to have the chance to just peruse it and see what's going on in the department. We try to keep it up to date with the most fascinating stories of what our soldiers, airmen, and state employees are doing.
If I could interrupt for just 1 second,
yes, sir.
And I would like to draw your attention to page 19, the article that's on there. This happens to be a favorite article of mine because I happen to have taught this individual's brother, and I know the family very well, and this is a very moving story, and it has great tribute to not only what has gone on with this individual's service to his country, but also highlights some of the other programs that we support, in particular the Youth Academy. So I would like to encourage you to read that article later. It's very, very moving.
Chairman, Chairman Roses, actually to focus on that article, that's a great example as we're talking about the Youth Academy, because this individual, as many as we've graduated from the Youth Academy, We have so many success stories, it's hard to always quantify them. But this individual personally, I've met a number of times, and I actually met him back in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago when he was going to Annapolis. And he was explaining it was the Youth Academy. It was the Youth Academy that changed his life and put him on the focus where he could be a naval officer and pursue what his dreams are. And if nothing else, that's the testimony I'm going to be giving today when I get to the Youth Academy, is what it does for Alaskans and how it's cost effective.
Thank you. And I would also like for the record to reflect that we are joined in the audience by Representative Gutenberg and also Representative Dahl.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, the overview I'm going to break down, I'm going to talk about the different divisions. And at any time, if you would like to have anybody ask questions, they may, because there will be information I talk about and they may want to discuss in particular a little deeper detail, so I'd be pleased to stop if necessary.
And I, for the record, since this is our first meeting and people are not quite sure as to what my protocol is going to be, I intend to run this meeting fairly relaxed and informal. It will however be structured. It's not going to get out of hand, I can guarantee you that, but let's make it comfortable and pleasant for everybody involved. So please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first area I'd like to talk about is the Army National Guard. Your Army National Guard is a dynamic fighting force for America and for the state of Alaska. And over the last 4 years, it has evolved from a scout group that had the lowest number of soldiers we'd had in well over a decade. We were down to about 1,770. To a robust force that exceeded its end strength last year and is meeting our national needs across the world. Let me start with the deployments of our National Guard, because that's the focal point everybody's interested in. 4 years ago, we had virtually not deployed anybody from the Army National Guard overseas. We had Ichis, a colonel here, an NCO there. We were supporting as needed by individuals and at very low numbers. By the end of this year, we will have deployed over 1,400 Army National Guardsmen overseas to Iraq, Kuwait, or Afghanistan. That is approximately 75% of the Army National Guard. That is a tremendous change from just a few years ago. Currently, we have 570 in Kuwait on the border with Iraq. They're at Navstar Camp and other security checkpoints crossing the border. They are doing a security mission that is essential for America to be able to provide supplies into the theater and to make sure that what we provide is secure. We currently have 120 in Kandahar, Afghanistan. They're providing a variety of missions. Some are in the support area. Some are actually on patrol and security forces outside of the wire. And in fact, Colonel Steve Williams, who's the commander over there for the Alaska Guard, has actually been on national TV being interviewed about the Guard and our activities in Afghanistan. Kandahar, as you know, is one of the more serious areas in Afghanistan that still has Taliban resistance. And most of the stuff you hear about in Afghanistan is in the Kandahar area in southeastern Afghanistan. And I will tell you that the Alaska Army National Guard is performing outstanding in that theater. They are doing exactly as America asked for and doing it in an exceptional standard. We currently have two individuals with the Mongolians in Iraq. We have been doing a relationship with Mongolia for the last 4 years. Mongolia, and I'm going to talk about the partnership a little later on, but Mongolia is one of America's strongest allies in the war in Iraq. They have had a company over there for 4 years. They're in their seventh rotation right now. And when they went over there, they're under a Polish brigade, but because of the differences in culture and language and the fact that they were in the Baghdad area, they asked for American assistance. They wanted to have liaisons from the American military with them as they were doing their service in Iraq. And Alaska, which has a partnership with the country, stepped up and said, we'll do it. And we have consistently sent one NCO and one officer over to Mongolia and then into Iraq with every rotation of Mongolians that have been over in Iraq. And I am very proud of what they do. I mean, they step up as Alaskans. They're serving with a Mongolian company in a foreign land that's a hostile territory, and they're doing exceptionally well. The short story is that Major Steve Wilson, one of the first officers we sent over to Mongolia with the Iraqis, was awarded about a year ago a Mongolian National Award for his service to Mongolia. That was the rotation where the Mongolians actually had been attacked at the security entry point to where they were protecting a compound area. Steve was the American officer that was the liaison, and didn't do anything other than oversee the Mongolian response. And it was exceptional, and the Mongolians wanted to thank him. So your Alaskans are doing great things. We started a few years ago with, obviously, as everybody knows now, the 3rd Battalion right here, Charlie Company from Juneau. Major Joel Gilbert led the first group over to Iraq. They served. They've come back. 1st Battalion from Nome has had a company over in Iraq. They've come home. Exceptional services. We have had aviation over in Iraq. The Blackhawk helicopter served a year. Our C-23s, the fixed-wing aircraft, they've been over in Iraq. They redeployed down to Kuwait, came home, and they're now on notice they're going to go back. We have volunteers. I met at a town hall meeting with them this weekend, was talking to the aviators and others, and Americans who say, we understand what we're doing, we're ready to go back. They will deploy, redeploy in the next 60 days. And finally, we have one last deployment, at least last as I know it today, about 170 strong this summer that will be deployed to Iraq into the Baghdad area. There are also a scattering of others, training teams, embedded training teams, and others in Iraq. I tell you that because I want you to know and really appreciate the depth of which the Army National Guard in Alaska has transformed from an at-home scout group to a lean-forward, combat-ready organization that is ready to take the next transformation, which is what I want to talk about next. The Army's transforming. The scout group that we had before was a honorable byproduct of the Cold War. We looked and watched to the frontier. In case the Soviet Union were to invade America, the first to see them would be the scout group, the members along western and northwestern Alaska that were right across from the Soviet Union. As the Cold War ended, that construct became irrelevant. And the only way we were going to have relevancy is changed to a structure that the Army appreciated. And we elected to do an infantry brigade combat team, IBCT. To do an IBCT, it's about 3,000 strong. Well, we don't have 3,000 in the Army National Guard, so we teamed with Guam, with Nebraska, Indiana, Arizona, California to build this IBCT. We're now looking at maybe changing to a battlefield surveillance brigade, which is smaller in size but could be done by Alaska. So the transformation process is not complete. We are still in the means of changing to what is relevant for America and still serves the needs of the Alaska Army National Guardsmen. My goal for them is to have skills that apply back here in Alaska. We need police. We need law enforcement individuals that can be hired in the private sector and that can also serve in rural Alaska, whether it's VPSOs or anything else. By converting to a brigade that has a lot of military police, we can provide law enforcement training, therefore increasing their opportunities to getting civilian jobs in the state of Alaska. So we're looking at the next form of transformation to fit the state needs as well as the national needs, and I'm very proud of what they're doing. I don't want to forget about missile defense, because at Fort Greeley we have missile defense, about 205 Alaskan Army National Guardsmen full-time, and they provide the security to America. The only missile defense field in the country is at Fort Greeley. It is 100% staffed, manned by Alaska Army National Guardsmen when it comes to the security of the missile field and the launch operations for the missiles. Now, I will tell you, there's a picture in, the, I think it's the annual report, of Secretary Rumsfeld and myself, and we are at Fort Greeley, and you can see grins on each face. So that happened after July 4th. On July 4th of this past year, you remember, the Koreans launched a missile, and the test was, is that a long-range missile, and will it be able to reach Alaska and beyond? It didn't fly very long, so that in itself is a separate story. But Secretary Rumsfeld visited Greeley to look and see what type of operation we had there. And when he went into the facility, he talked with the soldiers. This is a national missile defense program, the only missile defense for America. He had assumed they were active duty Army. And when he got in there and started talking to the soldiers, they said, well, where are you from? Well, I'm from this town, and I'm from that town. And he said, and are you active duty? No, we're Guard. You're Guard? We're Alaska National Guard. And that's the conversation that the Secretary had for the next half hour with soldiers is, hey, you're the National Guard, and you're doing this mission, and it went so well in July. And he asked them, were you ready to execute the mission? And there was, yes, sir, 100% was their answer. So I share that so you can appreciate the diversity of what we're doing in the Army National Guard and the respect they've gained nationally for the services they provide. Recruiting and retention, I mentioned that the low we had a few years ago, 1770. I will tell you today we've exceeded our goal. We have the highest numbers in well over a decade. We're over 1950 right now. We're going to exceed 2,000 by the end of this year, and our goal for next year set by National Guard Bureau was 2,050. Excuse me. I have no doubt we're going to reach that. We We have soldiers joining. In fact, I was at the airport 2 days ago, and a recruiter came up with a new recruit and introduced me. And I didn't talk to the recruiter. I asked the recruit, why'd you join? He goes, I'm an Alaskan. I want to serve, but I don't want to go active duty. I want to stay home. I want to be part of the Guard, and I'll do my service as needed. But majority of my life, I want to have a civilian job and use the Guard as a support for education, as a support to get skills training for a job, but to stay in Alaska. So people in Alaska still want to be in the Guard because it gives them great training, gives them a little bit of pay, and allows them to stay home while serving America as well. Lastly, I want to talk about construction for the Army National Guard because of these changes and all that's going on, there's a lot of construction activity going. We recently, about a year ago now, a year and a half ago now, dedicated the new Juneau Readiness Center. And if you have not been to the Juneau Readiness Center out at Auk Bay, I invite you to come out there. We'd be glad to give you a tour of it. It is a unique project in America. We teamed with the university, and so it is a joint complex with a gym and facilities that the university can use for recreation, and we use as a drill hall floor and for PT training and other skills trainings we need. And we also have office space available in that building, so we have the traditional administrative functions going on with the National Guard. And off the record, well, not really off the record, but kind of as a side, I joined back in 1970 when I joined ROTC and the Vietnam War was still going on. And I have friends who tell me universities were not friendly places for the military in the 70s and the late 60s. And here today in Juneau, Alaska, we have the university and the National Guard team together with an armory and a recreational facility for the university that's the best in the country. So America's grown, your National Guard's grown, and I'm pretty proud of what we're doing. We're in the process of building an armory in Bethel. We have cleared the dirt. We need to secure the last part of federal funding in order to complete that facility, but that should be done in the next 24 months if the funding flows properly. And then we'll do the Nome Readiness Center. Our five-year plan had been to complete Juneau, complete Bethel, and start Nome. We may take a little bit longer. It may be more like a seven-year plan now because back in Washington, they've had to slip some of the military construction projects to fund some of the equipment needs for Iraq and Afghanistan. But they've not canceled any programs. The programs are still on the book, and we are advancing on Bethel, and we're advancing on Nome. So that really covers the 30,000 view of the Army National Guard. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to entertain them on the Army. I'd like to move on to the Air Guard.
Any questions of anybody on the panel?
Very quickly on the Air Guard, Mr. Chairman, members, is they too are changing, and their transformation is probably more dramatic than the Army National Guard because it's so visible. The biggest change is the relocation of Culos Air National Guard Base over to Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. That is part of the Base Realignment and Closure Act that passed last year. It was recommended Culos be moved, provided funding is available. We, the state of Alaska, have been negotiating with the Air Force for the past year to ensure that the proper funding was identified. And about 2 weeks ago, the Air Force made the announcement that Culos would move because funding had been agreed to at $160 million plus some change. And I'll sit here today and tell you that is correct. We concur that at $160 million of federal dollars to rebuild what is needed at Culos over at Elmendorf, if that happens, your Air National Guard for Alaska at Culos will be a first-class operation operating out of Elmendorf. And for those from the Anchorage area that are concerned moving onto an Air Force base might not be good for the Guard, I will direct your attention to Fairbanks, where the 168th Air National Guard wing, which is a tanker wing in Fairbanks, has operated at Eielson for 20 years. And we've operated exceptionally well. I was a member of the 168th Air Refueling Wing at Eielson in the Fairbanks area, and I can tell you, it's a good Air Guard operation. So moving on to an Air Force base does not mean you are losing your Guard heritage, culture, or operations. It's how you execute when you're on that Air Force base. And at Culos, with the bill of $160 million being met by the Air Force, we'll be structured so that we can be an Air National Guard wing on an active-duty Air Force base. We will gain four C-130s, the propeller air transport aircraft, at Elmendorf, once we move on there, we'll go up to 12. That's a 50% increase in C-130 aircraft. That's good for Alaska. That provides me more flexibility. We will gain some active-duty Air Force personnel into the 176 wing to help us operate that wing with those additional 130s. That's good for us to have that Air Force integration with us. We will gain C-17s this summer, being an associate with the Air Force. The first one arrives in June, the last one by the end of the year, and we will be part of the C-17 team flying missions around the world. This is dramatic, phenomenal stuff for the Alaska Air National Guard. And I think you'll watch that transformation, be very proud that you were here watching it from the beginning and making sure that it functions right for the state of Alaska as well as for America. On the deployments, the Air Guard has been as active or more than the Army, but it's a different type of deployment. First off, the Army deploys for a year boots on ground. So when they get mobilized, they go to training. When they go to Iraq and Afghanistan, they're there for a year. Then they come back and redeploy. The Air Guard goes for 90, 120, 180 days, different cycles based on different missions. They also operate from a more developed area, such as Bagram Air Base, Kandahar Air Base, not quite so remote. So it's a different type of mobilization. But because of that, they've been very active. All of last year, the 176 Wing out of Kulis was the lead agency for airlift out of Afghanistan. They just came home last month. The last cadre came home. And I will tell you, I went over and visited them last spring, and the service they provide is phenomenal. It was a composite of many states, but the lead organization was the Alaska Air National Guard. They had the command and control for the airlift operations there, and they did it for a year. Lots of different things occurred while they were in Afghanistan, but at the end of the day, it was a phenomenal mission done by Alaskans. We've had our combat search and rescue individuals deployed all over the place. Right after September 11th, 2001, our combat search and rescue individuals were deployed out to Uzbekistan, somewhere in Pakistan, sort of surrounding Afghanistan. Eventually, they were in Afghanistan doing the initial recovery for air assets in the initial strike into Afghanistan. That was the Alaska Air National Guard. Additionally, the tankers have been all around the world, whether it's Guam, whether it's Turkey, whether it's operating out of Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan on airlift missions. They have a mission that is tapped all the time to provide fuel for the fighters and other aircraft as they fly across the Atlantic and across the Pacific, and they are constantly engaged. One of the ones I want you to be aware of is the upcoming deployment of the Air National Guard for security forces in Iraq. The Army has requested the Air Force and the Air National Guard provide security in the MP function in Iraq. So the Alaska Air National Guard is going to be providing 30 to 40 security police in the Air Guard to be basically doing Army missions inside Iraq on security. It's a new mission, but we're ready to do it. Our volunteers, virtually all of them that I'm aware of right now, have already been over to Iraq, Saudi Arabia, or Afghanistan before. They understand the environment, and they're ready to serve again. This could be more than 120 days. It could be a six-month deployment. The details are still being worked out. I can't tell you the location, and I really don't know the duration. But I can tell you, because it's public knowledge, that the Alaska Air National Guard security forces, 176, 168th, are being asked to serve in a security relationship over in theater coming up this year. Lastly, on recruiting and retention for the Air Guard, it too is doing exceptionally well. I want to dispel a rumor, though. For those of you from the Anchorage area that are hearing that the move of Kulis over to Elmendorf is resulting in a reduction in the Air Guard and that we're losing personnel because of that move, it's not true. If you're hearing that, I can categorically tell you there's no relationship to what you're hearing and the loss of people. Yes, the Alaska Air National Guard is going to reduce itself by about 100 individuals. That manpower reduction is based on a reallocation around the country of states that have recruited over 100% and those that have recruited to less than 100%. Those that can't recruit to 100% have vacant positions. Those that recruit to 110% are recruiting a lot of people to positions they don't have. The National Guard Bureau is realigning some positions from states that can't recruit to states that can. In Alaska, during my 4 years in the Air Guard, we have not been at 100% in either wing. And so the National Guard has said, well, you know, then we need to move these to some other states where they are over 100%. And I concur. It will not hurt our mission one bit. It will not hurt our ability to operate one bit. We're realigning the entire organization to meet the new needs of what the Air National Guard and the Air Force has. And when you talk to the wing commanders and when you talk to the Air Guard commander, they'll tell you the same story. The realignment's okay with us because it properly aligns us. Plus, it gets us close to 100%, and therefore we aren't a focus at Garbure about why we're not achieving 100% recruitment. With that said, it's not a negative story. We are still recruiting very well. Our numbers are up. We're about a little over 90%, and we just opened a new joint recruiting office in Fairbanks that has the Army and the Air Guard together. And I'm told that in the first few months of operation, where we used to only get two or three people a month come through the door, we're getting five or six a week. So it equates to like 20 to 25 a month, up from two or three. This location is a good location, and it's attracting a lot more individuals interested in joining the Army or the Air Guard. Quickly on Mongolia, the partnership I talked about earlier. I'm sorry. Yes.
I was just wondering what factors come into play as to why you're not at 100% recruitment.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. There's a number of reasons. We've not been that way for a long time. I will say it's not because of the global war on terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's primarily because some of the career fields we train into are very competitive on the civilian side, and people would rather spend their time making money on the civilian side than having to do that weekend a month, or maybe taking away from that job that they have as a civilian if they have to get deployed, not because they don't want to be deployed, but because of their civilian desires. The Air Guard is a fairly technical career field, and it attracts individuals in the computer industry and in the medical industry, and these are very competitive industries on the outside.
Could I follow up?
Please.
Why wouldn't that be the case with the communities and the regions outside that are at 110%? I mean, wouldn't they be recruiting from the same technologically oriented group of people?
Through the chair, ma'am, the demographics are tremendously different between states. Let's use California as an example. Yes, I concur with you that Silicon Valley is highly technical, and in the San Francisco area, the National Guard has a difficult time recruiting. But when they move down to the Fresno area, which is an agricultural-based community, that wing has no problem recruiting to the highly technical career field because there people enjoy working in the agricultural business and other Central Valley businesses that allow them the opportunity still to fly, still to do medical stuff on the side. You go to a state like Louisiana, and in there the National Guard is more of a tradition within families, and lots of times families will grow into the Guard as part of what their obligation is. It's a cultural feeling similar to what we have in Western Alaska with the Native community. There, grandfather's in the Guard, father is in the Guard, I'm going to be in the Guard. But we don't have air assets in rural Alaska. We only have them in Fairbanks and Anchorage. So we have them in only the high technical areas, and that's where we're having to recruit from, as opposed to other states which have different demographics than we have. So your analogy does work in many parts of the country, and the Bay Area is one where it's exactly the same scenario occurs. But in other areas with different demographics, they just don't face that problem. And that's generally where the higher numbers are. Tennessee has a high number. They're recruiting left and right. They're especially in Memphis. Federal Express has a hub there. I think there's like 30,000 Federal Express employees, and they can go fly for the Guard, or they can be maintenance people for the Guard, or they could do logistics for the Guard, because that's what they do in their civilian job. And so it's at the same airport. The dynamics are different in communities, and so we've faced that challenge. We understand that challenge, and that's why a reduction to some degree, as long as we realign the skills properly, is not going to be detrimental to the Alaska Guard.
Just one more follow-up. You think that originally the numbers that were set for your being at 100%, that there was something off with those numbers? I mean, if you've never met them.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, the numbers were assigned based on the aircraft you have. So it's a standard cookie cutter that goes to every state. You have 8 130s. Here's what you get for medical, supply, logistics, communications, cops, all the stuff. Now, as we go to recruit, we find that some areas we just aren't recruiting as strongly in as other areas. Again, another state may have a different demographic issue, but all of them are done cookie cutter. What the National Guard's trying to do is break the cookie cutter approach and tailor the Guard in each state to what the state can support so we can have it staffed across the country at 100%. What I didn't mention, and one of the challenges the nation's facing, is the Air Force, in order to modernize, it's very expensive, and they're doing 40,000 people being cut out of the military in about a two-year period. That's a significant number out of the Air Force, a reduction of 40,000 people in about 2 years. The Air Guard is not taking any cuts nationally. We're at 106,000. We're going to stay at 106,000. So we're expecting a lot of those 40,000 will flow into the Guard, and we're keeping our numbers up. So what we're trying to do is, of those 106,000, balance them between states, so everybody stays at 100%, so we reach 106,000 nationally, and we can absorb all we can from the Air Force, and we can meet the needs the Air Force and the nation has at that high number. It's a good plan, and I'm not here to tell you anything other than I think it's going to work. And the way it's structured right now with the coolest move, it's going to work for Alaska.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Boop.
Were you going to go on into any more detail about some of the things that you do within the state?
I have Mongolia, Homeland Security, Emergency, and yes, sir.
You were going to talk about some of the things you do within the state for just the residents of Alaska along with that.
Through the chair, in the National Guard side or other parts? Because I still have much more to talk about.
Okay. Continue.
All right. Thank you.
Save your question until
I will.
Our Mongolia relationship started 3 years ago, and it's a relationship that is designed by the State Department and the Department of Defense to allow America to develop relationships with emerging democracies in a more passive way than just having the State Department go out there. So they asked states to marry up with countries. We married up with Mongolia because it's very similar to Alaska in many, many ways. They have a heavy rural geography with no infrastructure. They are heavily dependent upon resources. And other than the ocean, they have no ocean. We have a lot of ocean. But other than that, there's a lot of similarities. That the relationship has developed well. I've already told you about Iraq. But from the Alaska perspective, as recently as November this year, Fairbanks has offered to the city of Ernadet in Mongolia to establish a sister city relationship. So this program is moving beyond just the National Guard, but into the state of Alaska and into the cities like Fairbanks that are trying to establish a sister city relationship, and I think they're doing it effectively. The university in Erdenet is talking to the University of Fairbanks. The Chamber of Commerce is communicating now, and certainly the mayor's office. We're also seeing that it's evolving in the trade industry, where their natural resources development is important to them, but they're landlocked with Russia and China, and so what they're trying to do is find economical ways to do resource development that can also be used in Mongolia. And that's attracting business interest in Alaska, and I suspect in the near future you'll see some businesses in Alaska that are starting to establish relationships with Mongolian businesses. So the end result of this relationship, while it's good for the country because it gets us in under the radar screen for emerging democracies, for Alaska it's starting to show that it's beneficial in state and local affairs from both the political side as well as the business side. And so I encourage you to stay focused on Mongolia. Each magazine, I usually try to have a small article on Mongolia, and certainly the annual report reflects it. But this evolving relationship, I think, could be very effective and beneficial to Alaska. Moving more into the homeland security and emergency management aspects of what we do in the department right now, when we started 3 years ago, homeland security only had a few people in it, and it was really separate from emergency management. We started by putting it all under one division and calling it homeland security and emergency management and increasing the staffing in homeland security significantly. I think that's been very effective. We've developed security and vulnerability assessment teams that go out to business to help look at what the security risks might be. We give them the report. They then can apply security as they feel they need to. They can apply for grants using the product that we give them. We have made pretty good progress along the pipeline, working with Alyeska, working with others on enhancing some security opportunities. And that homeland security has really evolved well. Emergency management and homeland security is going to get a new direction, though. One of the things I'd like to talk to you today about is I put in a new director. His name's John Madden, and you know him from the homeland security side, but he's now the division director for emergency management and homeland security. And I will talk about emergency management in a second, but the change that I'm doing is I'm asking John to look at, can we bring these two separate unities more closely aligned together? We have grant writers in both. I want to get one grant writing section because I think that provides much more efficiency. I want to see one process developed in the administrative services side, procurement, contracts, and other things, so that we're not getting duplicate services and that we can surge where the needs are with the whole team as opposed to only half the team. I think that's going to be very beneficial to the state of Alaska and to you as that evolves. Now, the importance of that when I talk about emergency management is we're getting a lot more emergencies now. And it's been a significant increase in the last few years. In this last year, we had 6 very significant ones, all state disasters, going on to federal disasters. And we need to be able to respond and flex when that need occurs. And so when we're having major storms, the staff can't be bifurcated where one staff is sitting there doing services that could be delayed 30, 60 days and be put on an important mission. We need to put them all together. And so as we go through the coming years, I think you're going to see more of a combined effort with Homeland Security and emergency management so that you don't have to pay for duplicate efforts in the staff. From the emergency management side, I know you're all aware, and the reports tell you of the number of emergencies and disasters we've had, but something is happening in our environment that's causing us to have more floods, more sea storms, more wind storms, the things that are causing tremendous property damage, coastal erosion, and serious impacts to communities around the state. It's not just located in one area. We are going to continue to face that, and as I've mentioned in other briefings, the Disaster Relief Fund is going to be one thing you're going to want to look at, because as it's funded today, it's very difficult for me sometimes to respond in a timely manner to communities that need relief. So I'll ask you to look at that Disaster Relief Fund as one mechanism that you could do to help make it so the state can be more responsive to communities around Alaska. On the Homeland Security side, when we're talking money, I will also tell you that you're going to feel the pressure from communities as they talk about the reduction in dollars. A few years ago, we had $19 million from the feds provided in Homeland Security. This past year, it was $6.7 million, and I understand it's going to continue to go down. So as we're looking at Homeland Security and emergency management, paying attention to the budget today is more important than it's been the past few years, making sure that the services we provide are the essential services Alaskans need provided, and that we then have the proper funding between federal and state to meet those needs. I will tell you the Hooper Bay fire was an example of where I think the state was exceptional in its response. The fire occurred in the school, burned down 14 homes plus a store right in the vicinity of the school. We got the call, and within hours there was a response out to Hooper Bay from the Bethel area, from the local emergency responders in Bethel and some of the community towns right around that, followed shortly thereafter by state response. We had a state emergency responder out there, followed within 48 hours by a team that was in place. We opened up the armory out at Hooper Bay. We had the State Defense Force mobilized. We had some National Guard people mobilized and sent out there. They provide security with the local, under the jurisdiction of the local police. And we had opened up our individual assistance and disaster declaration office inside the armory. We quickly mobilized for housing because that's what was needed. We're talking fall and the winter's coming fast, and so we mobilized, and through the private sector, through other nonprofits, and through the state, we were able to secure 15 houses in different components. Five were built, five were modular, five were kind of ATCOs that were shipped in by barge, and ultimately five to replace the ATCO were built later on, and within a short period of time, that community had housing, and now the new school's been opened. I share that with you to make sure you understand. I feel very proud of what we do in emergency management. We are managing things exceptionally well. The tsunami, the potential tsunami that just occurred last month, we got the call while the waves were still being developed over in the Russian Far East in Japan. We were starting the notification system all the way down the chain. The notice where I was on TV, across the screen, yes, there were different notices. There were some in red, some in gray. It depended on what agency was putting out at the moment. It was very time critical, though, that people at least know there's the potential of a tsunami. That night by 10 o'clock, I was already on Channel 2 talking to them about what the reaction was, whether we were going to actually have a tsunami and where it could potentially go to and what people should do. As it was a non-event. A small wave that passed through the Aleutians and did no damage to anything. But the fact was the alerting network and the response team and the coordination between local jurisdictions and the state and the federal agencies worked perfectly. And so while sometimes we see in the press concerns about the way it was handled in Indonesia when they had a tsunami, or whether floods and hurricanes were handled down in Southeast America, United States, Alaska, our demonstrated track record is that the structure we have in place for emergency response is serving the residents very well today. So I'd ask you to keep that in mind as you're looking at my structure and future decisions about how you may want to change this. Don't break something that's good. If you're looking at things, let's look at how we can improve things in the future. Which brings me to the Alaska Military Youth Academy, a great program. Alaska Military Youth Academy, we're at 2,000 graduates, over 2,000 graduates now. We're going to graduate on March 3rd, the largest class we've ever graduated, 156 strong. And that organization is growing. And I always advertise it as there's a cost to the Youth Academy. There's a cost to the state, It's not all done by the federal match. The state is paying for it through the Education Foundation formula. So it's an accredited school that gets funding predicted just like all other school districts. But whatever you spend on the Youth Academy, say it's X, you're saving 5X by not having to incarcerate people later on. You're saving in the law enforcement and the corrections process by turning people around. This is a volunteer program. Excuse me. It's a volunteer program, and the students that graduate from that program, well over 95% lead productive lives after that. We track them for a year afterwards. We have very few in that first year that fall out. And like you saw in the article, we track them informally for a couple of years after that, and we find most of them end up going to college, join the military, going to an academy, getting a job, a regular union job that provides security and a future for them. And it is shown that that cost offsets a significant other cost in the law enforcement correction side later on. We have received national excellence awards for training, for mentorship, for our education process with industry, and we've expanded the Starbase program as part of the Youth Academy.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Senator Ledoux.
The Youth Academy, as I understand it, it's totally voluntary. So nobody's there because they're court ordered in a delinquency proceeding. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct. It's 100% volunteer. And so the numbers are high of applicants, and we use it. You do a 2-week course, which is get up at 4 o'clock, don't shower, don't shave, don't eat. We're going to do push-ups. We're going to run. Let's do a few things. If you're good, we might let you shower. And then if you're good, you might get to eat. And then it's a hard day of work, and it's more push-ups before you go to bed about 9 o'clock at night to get your 7 hours of sleep. And if you're not good, you can sleep on the floor. And that program weeds out about 25% that say, wait a second, I didn't know this was going to be hard. I don't really want to do it. Fine. Then we're glad that you self-execute elimination early on. After that, we give them a break and we bring them back, and those individuals are the ones that spend the 5 months in training. And we do have a dropout rate from those. Not everybody wants to take the whole program through. Unfortunately, we've had kids actually drop out the week before graduation. I can't understand why you would do that for 4 months, 3 weeks, and then drop out. But we've had some that have done that. Very few. The group that graduates, and I'd invite you all to be there March 3rd, 10 o'clock in the morning, Buckner Fieldhouse at Fort Richardson, that group are outstanding Alaskans that want to serve.
Go ahead, follow up.
Have you ever tried to interview afterwards those folks who've dropped out after 4 months, 3 weeks, and 5 days?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we don't. We interview them on their exit. Why are you leaving? And I can tell you the millions of reasons why they are leaving, but primarily they just don't like the structure. There are a few that leave because there are family problems that they need to go attend to. There are a few that believe they're just not going to achieve what they want out of life. That's few and far between. Most of them just don't like the structure, and they're just ready to go back to their old life.
After
It's across the board, through the chair. It's across the board, from dropping out the first week after they start to dropping out the fourth month. It really is across the board. I mean, I'm not sure. You all probably have been involved with exit surveys and interviews before. You're not really sure you're even getting the truth. Sometimes you may be told a story they just want to tell you so they can get the heck out of there.
Thank you.
Veterans is another part of my department, and in the veterans area, we've had a fairly aggressive period. We're looking forward to some more support in the future, especially in Operation Stand Down. We do that in Fairbanks. We do that in Anchorage. And that is for veterans, primarily homeless veterans. And I'm not necessarily asking for money. The Operation Stand Down gets a lot of support with donations. And so primarily the support I'd like you to pay attention to, since you are the DMVA committee, is when we do Stand Down, you're always welcome to come and meet with these homeless veterans, these veterans that are trying to change their lives, and help encourage them to do that. And I'd be glad to honor you there and let them know you're there so you can talk to them. Because these individuals, they've served America well. And for whatever reason, they've got lost in the system. I don't know whether it's a system problem or their problem. It's probably a combination of everything. But they're good Americans that have served. And we need to make sure that we continue to provide whatever they they are seeking at that moment in their lives. And Operation Stand Down does a good job of providing them. We always provide some parkas, some shoes, good food. We bring out the VA for counseling. We have a clinic there so they can get their blood pressure and some stuff checked. We try to make it a friendly, homey environment. We do some counseling sessions available to them, and we usually release an eagle just so we can come together and have a little spiritual relationship of life and what it means to be an American and an Alaskan. So your participation in that is not always money. Sometimes just your presence is very, very important to those that are in need. We've also exceeded our goal in the Alaska Territorial Guard, but we're discharge certificates, but we're not done. We're well over 170 discharge certificates issued so far. We'll probably be at 200 shortly. There are probably still another 100 to 150 of living Territorial Guard members that need to be honored with this discharge certificate. So in the process, your support of that program is going to be important to those Alaskans that served in World War II and did not get properly recognized when they left the service. And I will tell you that even when we reach the goal, let's say every single living Territorial Guardsman has their discharge certificate, I don't think we're done. There were 6,600 that served, and there are still family members of those that have passed away that would be honored to get that recognition so that they at least know that America recognized the service their loved one did while serving America during World War II. So in my opinion, this program is not only about the living veterans, but about the veterans' families that also need to be recognized for that service. There is one issue I wanted to bring to your attention before I just talk about a couple things I'd like to have you be aware of for 2007. One is a very important issue dealing with the National Guard and our federal relationship with the federal government. The National Guard was established in the 1600s, 1636, and it was established by neighborhoods, by communities, by villages to protect themselves from anybody who would attack them. So the concept was, We're a farming community. We've got 25 guys that can shoot a gun here. One weekend a month or every couple months we'll go out and let's shoot together and just drill together and kind of also keep an eye out on each other. And if you see something happen in the farm over there, maybe we all ought to go over and check it out. That evolved into a militia concept where neighborhoods would take care of neighborhoods, villages from villages, and eventually when we became a country and had states, the Constitution embodied in the states the right to have a militia to protect the state. I am here working for the governor because I'm the Alaska National Guard to protect Alaskan interests. The National Guard comes together as the National Guard of the United States under a separate part of the code, so when the president needs to use us as an additional military force, in addition to his active duty and in addition to the reserves, the National Guard can be activated. That is not our primary role. Our primary role is to serve our state, and mine is to serve Alaska. Because of Hurricane Katrina and some of the issues that came out of that, the federal government believed that they needed to be more proactive in emergency response in states. Through Northern Command, they managed to craft and have passed in the last legislative session, Washington, change in the federal law, which allows the president to activate the National Guard to be used in the state for state emergencies without the consent of the governor. We cannot allow that law to stand. That changes the constitutional concept of the National Guard from the beginning. When this passed, it passed over the objections of every governor in the country. 54 governors signed a letter to the president saying don't enact this law. 54 adjutant generals in the country, every state and territory, signed that same statement, don't pass the law. Currently, the National Governors Association is developing a response to change the law back to the way it was before. Governor Palin has been briefed that this is a positive change for Alaska. We need to go back, and she's looked me in the eye and said that I'm a states' rights governor, and I understand what needs to be done. So I'd encourage you to be aware of that issue, and if you're attending national forums for elected officials, make sure that's part of the discussion. What do we need to do in America to make sure states retain states' rights? And one of the ones to do is to make sure the National Guard works for the governor. That's who we were intended to work for. That's who we need to work for. The president can activate us for national issues, certainly, anytime the president feels necessary. But I tell you that when it comes to responding to a flood out in southwestern Alaska, I don't need the president to tell me how to get soldiers in the National Guard out to southwest Alaska. Governor Palin and I can get the people we need to southwest Alaska. There is a provision in the national law where the federal military authority can support the state. It's called the Military Support Civil Authorities. And I support that. And in that law, which would not be changed by what I'm telling you, if the governor determines that the assets the state has is not adequate and we do need federal support, there's the mechanism to ask for that. And the relationship I have with General Frazier and General Jacoby here in state, it's a seamless relationship. And I can assure you, if I was out in southwest Alaska and needed support from the federal side for something, all I would need to do is pick up the phone and call General Frazier and say, sir, here's what the request will be from the governor. And when the governor issues that request, the federal government would be there to support us. We don't need the current law to do good business in the state of Alaska. We're already structured for that. Before I go on, I guess I'll open for question on that, because that may be an issue somebody wants to talk about.
Any questions from anybody on the committee? Sounds pretty straightforward.
Okay. A couple things for 2007 that I'd like you to be aware of before I conclude. One is I work by strategic plan. If you go to my webpage today, you'll see my strategic plan that was developed in 19. I haven't been around doing this that long. 2004. My 2004 or 2008 strategic plan. If you purview that plan, you'll recognize that most in that plan is being accomplished now, has been or is in the process of being accomplished just through the briefing I gave you today. But we're going to redo the strategic plan. We've already started. The focus of what I need to have accomplished from my department, which includes the National Guard, is what are the principal core values we need to provide for the state of Alaska? And kind of reflects back to what your question is. Yeah, I have forces that are ready to serve America, and I think we've transformed in the last 4 years to what America needs from the Army and the Air. But now, is there anything we need to be doing to change what we do so that we provide better service to the state of Alaska? I will tell you that the BRAC action of adding four C-130s to the state was good for us, because that provides me four more C-130s to provide airlift out to rural Alaska should I need to get people or supplies out there in emergencies. And the governor has the right to utilize those aircraft in an emergency. I won't bother you with the technical part of the rules, but the rules are basically if the emergency occurs within 24 hours, she needs them, she's got them. After 24 hours, I have to basically ask permission because now it's not an imminent threat. After about 72 hours, it's probably going to be a bill flowing from federal government to us for using the equipment. But when it happens and I need it, and this afternoon I need a 130 to go out for an emergency that the governor has declared out somewhere in the state, that plane will be on its way today. There is absolutely no limitation. I want to make sure that those type of aspects from our National Guard as well as Homeland Security and state emergency management are being met, but probably thinking out of the box a little bit, what can we do different to provide enhanced services to the state of Alaska? And that's what the team's been challenged to do. In fact, I've got on my desk a little little box. It's a framed cage, and it's got a bent wire that hangs out like this. And the inside the box is a weight. And outside the box, way out here, is a little guy sitting at the end of the wire. You just touch the weight, and the guy bobs a little bit outside the box, and it says, think outside the box. I brought that as an example to the staff. I said, that's the way I look at the world. So in this strat plan, if you bring me back the canned answers of how we've done successful things in the past, you failed. What I'm looking for is what do we need to do different for the future for Alaskans? We are at the point now where our strength is up. We've got the people. I'm not concerned about recruiting and retention in the near term. We've got the structure almost in place that can serve America well and therefore can be used in Alaska. Now we need to make sure that that structure, people, and process is properly utilized and is available to Alaskans to the degree we may need in the future. Those are challenges that I can't sit here today and tell you what the answer is, but I can tell you that within about 120 days, you'll go to my webpage and that new strat plan will be there. And that's what I'll ask you to measure me on for the next few years. As I bring budgets forward, as I bring performance measurements forward, are they aligning to a more robust DMVA than we had the past 4 years? That's where I'm heading, and that's what I'm looking for from my department. We want to implement BRAC. I want to make sure it's done right. I want to make sure it's effective for the state. We are considering expanding the Youth Academy, as I talked about. That's part of the out-of-the-box stuff. Do we do it in the traditional way, or is there a way where we can serve the youth in other areas besides Anchorage that's more productive and maybe different, done differently? Talked about the Mongolia Civic Leaders Tour, the business tour that we're trying to establish for later this fall. And what I didn't mention is our Clear Air Force Station at Fort Greeley. At Fort Greeley, we have National Guardsmen I talked about with the missile defense, but at Clear, we have space surveillance. And we're in our final year of transferring that over to the Guard. And this year, Clear Air Force Station will have gone from the Air Force to the Air National Guard. Another 75, 80 full-time employees that will now be Alaskans year-round. So this coming year is going to be pretty aggressive. Getting the strat plan done, getting BRAC started, if we move on an expansion of the Youth Academy, transforming the Army Guard into the new concept, and then getting the right skills to serve Alaskans, and merging Homeland Security and Emergency Management to provide more efficiencies while providing greater services is going to be a challenge. But that's the challenge I've put on the table for my department. That's the challenge I'm sitting here telling you I want to accept. And if you're with me, when that strat plan comes out, you'll see the thinking out of the box concept being deployed by DMVA and will want me to be successful. If you don't agree with what you see at the end of the day, I suspect next year at this time I'm going to be having a difficult meeting with you, Mr. Chairman.
Entirely possible.
That concludes my comments for the overview of the department.
Okay, we thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Representative Boot.
You still didn't talk about one of the things I think is primarily important to almost anybody in this room. I was a recipient of your services in 2002. Everybody in this room, if you travel out to the bush, do whatever, I crashed in a plane on a mountain. These characters came and plucked me off, flew me back to Anchorage within hours.
There may be a question, sir, as to who the character was, but that's okay.
At any rate, in their abilities to do that, it was amazing to see the support that was there, the response, and that it's available. And this is also something that's geared into the rural bush for some of the medvac stuff, if it is required. So. That wasn't mentioned either. This is also incorporated in this state that we have available to through these people. So there's a lot of things that they do that you didn't talk about today that does directly affect us. So thank
you. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. You're right, and I should have caught the lead because we've had this conversation before. That group, those PJs that went to Uzbekistan and Afghanistan and Pakistan were the same group you're talking about, and I should have tied that together because the training they get is done here in the state. And as our pararescues will tell us, it's a great place to be in Alaska because there are so many people out doing so many things that are dangerous that we stay constantly trained and constantly proficient. We are able to get people from other states to come up to train with us because of the opportunities that you provide and others provide for our PJs. But it's more than that. I think it's in one of these magazines, or it was another one, the Ace Cougar, the ship that capsized out in the ocean. This is a tremendous story because the picture is of an Alaska Air National Guard helicopter bringing those seamen off the boat to bring them back to shore. Now, you'd ask a couple questions. Why wasn't that the Coast Guard? That wasn't the Coast Guard because the Coast Guards were involved in another rescue that was going on about 1,000 miles away, and there's no way they could have gotten there in time. And their helicopters aren't refuelable, so the distance they would have had to travel would have meant they would have had to land to gas. We were closer to the ship, and we had 130s with gas in them and helicopters that can be refuelable, so we flew nonstop out there. And so the Air National Guard's out there in the sea lane doing a sea rescue in Coast Guard territory while the Coast Guard's doing a land rescue in the territory of Alaska that they had assets at. The relationship of the Coast Guard and the Air Guard and the training they do and the opportunities are phenomenal in the state. What's not spoken about, at the same time that that's happening, we had Army National Guard that's trained to do rescues out in rural Alaska. We had them at Bethel and Nome on standby because it's coming up to winter time. There's hunting going on. And over the course of the fall and the winter, our Army National Guard helicopters are doing a lot of medevac operations concurrent with the Air Guard and the Coast Guard. So I appreciate that question because the state of Alaska gains a lot from having our Army Guard and Air Guard fly the Pave Hawk and the Black Hawk helicopter in rescue-type missions that's training for their national mission in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places in the world. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we thank you for your presentation, and if time permits, And you could stay around while we discuss these other bills, because they may have some impact on your department. I would appreciate it. If you have other commitments, I would understand.
I have a few minutes. I could stick around, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, we will now move to House Bill 45.
Would you like the window open a little bit?
Yes.
Please, the floor
is
yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goonberg.
Members of the committee. A few years ago, a woman who was the widow of a friend of mine, and I'm not sure that she knew that I had knew her husband, came to me and said that he had passed away. He was a retired Marine, and that he had wanted to be buried in Fairbanks and never had the opportunity to, because there's no vet cemetery in Fairbanks. No, that was Joyce Rothler. Rick Rothler was the dispatcher out of the laborers union when I joined in 1974, and he was a big old rough-voiced Marine with a big fat cigar in his mouth, and he kind of took all of us under his wing and took care of business. But for some reason, I just looked at it and I said I couldn't have imagined that Fairbanks had not tried to do it before, and it turns out all the years and the different legislators, nobody had actually tried to do it. And tried to explore the possibilities of getting a vet cemetery in Fairbanks, came to realize that we weren't eligible for another national cemetery, but Fairbanks was eligible for the state vet cemetery program. And this bill is a result of that. Last year it passed out of the legislature, and it didn't make it out of the other body. It had been amended in committee twice, and I thought both amendments were made the bill stronger. It right now makes anybody eligible, any community that is eligible for a vet cemetery can apply through the state and receive one. Basically, this legislation sets up the structure inside of the state that allows us to apply to the VA for a vet cemetery, and almost all the restrictions and structure that'll come out are controlled by the VA. And that's what I put before you for your consideration. Little did I realize the support it would have from the vets and service organizations around the state, and I think some of them are here, maybe online as well. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I do have some folks that are standing by, some in the audience and some online. So let's go to Joseph Fields in Fairbanks, who's the Vice Chair of the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council. Are you there, sir?
I am, sir. Thank you. Joe Fields from Fairbanks. I am Vice Chair of the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council, but I'm speaking here on my own behalf, and I'd like to commend Representative Gutenberg for sticking with this bill and bringing it back again. Last year's iteration had some difficulties, and of course now they've all been worked out, I believe. I have seen in this last year a growth in the need. Of course, we have more people deployed from around the state. That may give us greater need. I hope not. But looking at the demographics of our population, and especially I'm a Vietnam combat veteran, looking at our age group and the amount of time we'll have between now and the time this is done, we'll probably have a little bit more attrition than we'd like to have. But I would say that this bill has met all the needs, all the wants, and it should be acted upon in a very concrete and positive manner by the legislature. You should move it as quickly as possible, and I'm willing to take any questions.
Any questions from anybody on the committee for Mr. Fields? Representative Goodmark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out that some of Mr. Fields' concerns last year were funds being used for this would come from other VA benefits. And in the summer of 05, I think it was 05, the national director of this program came to Fairbanks and met with vet organizations. And I was relieved to hear that wouldn't be the case, because that's what I thought. And that what I had presenting to the committee was exactly what he was saying, because it's his program. It was his program. So I think Mr. Fields' concerns, and a lot of other people's, have been relieved.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Fields or Representative Gutenberg at this point? Okay, I have one. You said that there would be federal funds to accomplish this objective. Are those funds required to be passed through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs of the state?
I believe they are. I believe it becomes a, the state applies for a grant to the VA, and it comes back to the state, and it's construction, the original one is the construction grant to build a facility. And then after that, there's other things, there's burial. And I would assume that they become state appropriations, passing on federal dollars authorization in that way.
Representative Dulles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that question. The reason I got up and left the meeting earlier, Mr. Chairman, was to do a little bit of last-minute research as I was looking at this bill. I'm wondering if, Representative Guttenberg, have you met with General Campbell or other people in the department statewide to talk about the grant process? Do we know who the appropriate people are that need to fill it out and sign it, who would be responsible for processing the money? The reason I ask all this is I'm wondering if we should take a step back and maybe not necessarily form a subcommittee, but you as the bill sponsor have maybe some meetings with them to find out those details on what needs to be done. I think overall this committee, in fact, is very supportive, and I believe we'll probably pass the House unanimously, but I think we have some details on financing and how that money's going to be handled, where it's coming from, that I haven't been able to find out the answers to, and I went upstairs and made a couple phone calls and got some conflicting answers, so that's why I'm asking.
Do you know the answer to that question, or can we defer?
For the record, my name is Dana Krawczyk. I'm Staff Representative Guttenberg. If I understand correctly, the basis of the bill is to allow the state to apply mm-hmm. for this program and to then go forth and create those regulations from the department that would work within the state to create the cemetery. I know that within the national program, it allows for up to 100% of the construction and operation, and that I believe the only main cost of the state would truly incur is the yearly maintenance and then mm-hmm. the staff that would be required to keep the cemetery running year-round.
Okay.
We have been, over the years of working on this, we have been talking with somebody in the VA. Was it Mr. Beal?
Yeah. Jerry Bain, actually.
Jerry Bain, I'm sorry.
Okay. Follow up to the chair. All right. And I do know that gentleman, very knowledgeable. Have you spoke with anyone in the state level, say General Campbell or who? No. I'm not even sure who the appropriate agency would be, but I'm thinking it would be Military and Veterans Affairs that would right. be the actual signers of and responsible for the funding.
And that is correct. And I believe, through the chair, sorry, I believe that, and Jerry was our point of contact when this bill was started. He was the one that we were directed to deal with all of the information, because he is the one that controls the cemeteries in the state through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Is that here? We haven't spoken with the commanders because we were guided to Jerry to talk to.
Okay. So this is going to sound silly, Mr. Chair, but he's in charge of the cemeteries, or he's in charge of veteran cemeteries?
Veteran cemeteries, excuse me, in the department.
And who does he report to?
I believe the commissioner, but I'm not sure exactly who his.
So he reports to Commissioner Campbell?
No, to the the person in charge of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I believe. I'm not sure who his
okay.
line of contact or who his chain of command is.
I just know that from the way the federal process goes with this and the funding and the process that we have to follow to do it correctly, just from past experience, trial and error on my part, and I don't want you to have to go through that error part, I'm thinking we might could avoid some problems if maybe you as a sponsor had a meeting with say General Campbell and the others that he would deem appropriate to bring in.
I believe Mr. Beal is with the state. Mm-hmm. So he is the state inside the state contact.
General Campbell?
He works for him.
Can you respond to any of those questions that were asked? Thank you for staying behind. I thought this may come up.
Just for the record, I'm Craig Campbell. I am the Commissioner of DMVA and the Adjutant General for the National Guard, and Jerry Beal works for me. He is our Veterans Coordinator. He has a staff of one, him plus one. We have no cemeteries in the state right now that Jerry Beal's responsible for, but we are aware, Jerry has been working with the staff on legislation that may look at establishing a state cemetery. Other states have state cemeteries, and it's perfectly appropriate to look at a state cemetery for Alaska, and Jerry from the state side is the proper staff person to coordinate with on that. But at this point, no, I have not been had a discussion on the point.
Okay. And just one more question.
Sure.
Do you need to be involved?
Well, through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if the legislature is about ready to do some action on a state cemetery, I do believe that is appropriate, not just for me, but for the governor's office through the legislative liaison affairs office to have her a chance to review, because I at this point I've had no direction from the legislative office as to whether there's support or adjustments, and I haven't had the opportunity to review. I've read it. Jerry Beal has shown it to me, but I've not been asked to take an official position from the department on it, from this version that's before this legislature.
Okay.
Let me then ask a question, then I'll go to Representative Ledoux and Fairclough. Do you know in those guidelines that they're referring to at the federal level for funding, does it require that it be a separate standalone cemetery, or would it be possible, say, for example, if an existing municipal cemetery were there, to then add to that and have it as a separate section for the VA, or do they have to be standalone?
Chairman Rose, I don't know the answer to that. I've not been brought into it.
It isn't allowed.
It is not allowed. It says so specifically in federal regulation.
All right. Representative Ledoux, and then
my question is for Representative Guttenberg. I'm just wondering whether I'm missing something in this bill, because I'm seeing all of these support letters which talk about a veteran cemetery in Fairbanks, but I don't see Fairbanks specified in the bill, unless, as I say, I'm missing something.
Well, that was an amendment last year, and from what I've been told, Fairbanks is the only community that would be eligible. If you applied for a vet cemetery in Anchorage, a state vet cemetery, you wouldn't be eligible because you were in a certain demographics to the national cemetery that's on Fort Richardson. So Fairbanks meets the national VA's criteria for trying to reach out for other places. But the amendment into the bill last year would allow any community, has it become eligible, to also apply. So if Kodiak met the criteria, Kodiak as well could apply. That's why it doesn't just say Fairbanks.
In this bill?
In this bill, anybody meeting the criteria of the VA, state VA cemetery program that would meet their criteria could apply and be eligible for a grant.
But for all practical purposes, the only community which would actually meet the VA criteria would be Fairbanks.
At
is
this
that
point, yes,
correct?
Right now, yeah.
When you say at this point, how would the criteria be amended? Would that be a federal decision?
No, I think it's population growth, the number of VAs within a 75-mile radius, and right now the national cemeteries in Fort Richardson and Sitka exist. I don't think we're eligible for another national cemetery until we have a veteran population growth. So if you had veteran population growth, that would change the criteria.
Thank you.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Chairman Roses. First, my office misplaced our packet, and so at about 11:30 this afternoon, I went scrambling for the bills and read them. And so I did jet off at about 12:45, I think, questions to the sponsor of this. But first, I want to follow up on Representative Ledoux's comment. The first thing when I seated myself, I found a support letter from AARP specifically supporting a location in Fairbanks, and this bill does not specify a location. So I just want that on for the record, that this bill, while people are supporting one in Fairbanks, and that might be the only community that federally meets the definition requirements, that's not what this bill does. This bill sets up a framework for money to start accumulating so that we could pursue at a particular point in time a cemetery at a location that we would choose in the future. Is that correct?
No, it doesn't. It simply allows the MVNA to apply for a grant, and whether they're eligible or not.
It doesn't set up a fund inside the general fund?
It sets up a fund, but there's no money in it until it accepts the grant process happens, and the VA sends the money in, and that's where it would go to construct a cemetery.
Right. I think that we agree with each other. I had asked you earlier, and so just for the committee's consideration, I'm a freshman. I really don't know if we need to create an effective date, but inside of the document before you has a income date that starts as of July 1st, 2007. So I know that we have no money on the table now or anything else, but I don't know if technically we need an effective date so that if a legislature or if there were a donation to be received at a particular point in time, it just depends how quickly it passes, whether when the governor signs it, but I'm just asking for technical purposes whether it needs to have an effective date in the title. On page 2 of the document, under 3705.590C, and I did talk to Representative Grutenberg on this already, what this does is make sure that any money that would be allocated or donated or received from the feds into the fund, that it wouldn't lapse. And I think that that's a wonderful idea, to make certain that any money that is donated, allocated, or somehow makes its way to this particular funding line, that it be protected. And even though we don't dedicate funds, that people, especially if they donated, would donate for a specific purpose and want the money used and facilitated towards their dream. So my question here is, again, technical, and I don't know if we have anyone from the administrative side of the house, but I would think that general funds are managed differently than investment accounts, and so any funds that went into the GF side that just rolled would create a lower return on investment on a regular basis than funds that were managed somewhere else. So I would just ask for the committee's consideration, while we have GF funds, I'm not sure that they're invested in the same way, versus short-term investment and long-term investment, and how that money might work for us coming in. So it just for your consideration. And then lastly, under 26.10.030, I did check the citation on this, and inside of state statute, what this allows is for someone to provide a gift to the state of Alaska. And I do come with local experience in local economies, and would no way think that we should take my experiences as gospels for the state of Alaska, but I have been under the disadvantage of receiving a gift that bears with it some liabilities that the city in the past may not have wanted to take on. And by that I mean, if you get a piece of environmentally sensitive land and you have toxins on it. The trailer court in Muldoon, it had some environmental challenges to it, that there was quite a bit of remediation dollars required. A private sector individual took that on, but the city was involved in some of that oversight. And in speaking with the representative before us, he believed that this would fall under federal guidelines for receipt of a gift. But that's not how I read this particular statute. This particular statute cites state code, and it doesn't say that we're under a procurement process for that. And so, again, I know that I'm new, and maybe it all is covered administratively. I'm just throwing out so that I can learn more about the process, too, that a gift policy and a gift acceptance policy should certainly be a benefit to the state and not some undue liability that we might see.
Do you have a response for that?
Yeah, thank you. It is a very good question, and it is part of my illustration of we are living under the federal VA guidelines, and they do address that. I mean, the state, and this has been a problem before, I think, in every community, but in their establishing a state veterans cemetery, burial and memorials, their guidelines determining needs, and under investigating availability of land, it addresses, and if I can read it to you, it's just three lines. Suitable land should be easily accessible by road, free of limitations such as rock, steep slope, and wetlands, uncompromised by incompatible land use nearby, appropriate for cemetery use. Land use already owned by the state, municipality, county is usually best. State must have title of land. Under the next paragraph, analyze possible negative environmental and historic preservation impacts. So when we're applying, they will look at the land and say, that does not qualify. I mean, I would assume it would be part of the grant. And so, we have to apply to their guidelines.
So point of clarification, then I'll let you follow up. So we have to have the land designated prior to the application? It's not we put the application in and if the grant is given, then we secure the land?
No, the land has to be acquired first because it's
that's part of the criteria and the guidelines.
Criteria.
Okay, yeah. Follow up.
Thank you, sir. Representative, I want this to be the best bill it can be and successful. And what you're citing under United States federal requirements would be what we would have to meet for the feds. I'm talking about someone donating a gift to the state of Alaska, which is under our state statute. And while it might assess the impacts, it won't determine whether we qualify federally for the funds. What I'm saying is if my grandfather wants to donate to this particular fund line item, and I can give you a real life example in Anchorage, donates five hundred acres of swampland, which someone for the last 35 years has dumped their vehicles in, maybe old Army vehicles in, and there's going to be a cost to extract all those vehicles and make it environmentally sound. But if someone doesn't know that before we go in and we accept this wonderfully generous offer from a family who's wanting us to do it, and then we go in and we find there's liability issues, I'm just saying, from the state of Alaska, if we're going to accept gifts from someone, we should have a process whereby we limit the liability that the state would incur. You might find a surprise. Nothing to do with what the federal government would require for us defining a piece of property, but more like the gifts coming in that would hopefully realize cash profit inside of your fund line. So,
well, response?
Just response. We're applying for a federal grant.
You also have, if I might, Mr. Chair, DMV offering you commemorative plates and other abilities for other people to contribute to funds in creating this. So you've created a framework that gives you alternate revenue streams, and you're focusing very rightfully so on the grant process that's clean. There is another process that you've allowed entry to on two different levels, and some of it could have some potential liability that I'm wondering if other members might want to maybe we want to eliminate a donation clause altogether. But I would think we would want to accept, I mean, rightfully so, that you've included an opportunity for people to donate to the fund.
Representative LaDuke.
I'm just wondering whether or not that concern might be taken care of because of the word may, as opposed to the word shall, where it says the department may accept gifts. So there's really no obligation to accept gifts, as opposed to the use of the word shall, which means that they got to accept anything that's given to them. Just throw that out.
And I'm sorry, and I and the bill is there are no shalls, and we shall do this and shall do that. It's all may. I mean, in my work out there, there is no eligibility, and Fairbanks cannot come up with the land, in which case it just sits dormant until something else happens.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want this program to be successful and as broad as possible for the state of Alaska to receive money if it was successful, and a gift acceptance policy. It doesn't matter if it shall. Well, it does matter. I think it's permissive. The may is very good, but the issue is, does the state of Alaska have a gift acceptance policy? And at least on the citation that was in this particular bill before us, that particular statute citation does not include a policy. It just says we'll take gifts. And so maybe somewhere else in the administrative code. I'm new, so I apologize. I could be running around a circle that it's already taken care of. So.
I think that probably speaks to what Representative Dahlstrom was mentioning earlier about establishing the guidelines and the criteria. So I think that's part of that issue.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say the state does have a policy. I just can't tell you what it is right now, but we do have an established policy, and we need to find out exactly what that is.
Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor of the bill? Okay. We do have two folks in the audience that have signed in, that one to ask questions and one that would like to testify. So, Pat Luby, please identify yourself and your position, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. In addition to my position with AARP, I also served as an Army Ranger in Vietnam and Cambodia. I'm here as one of the many thousands of Alaska veterans. AARP has submitted a letter in support of HB 45. Many AARP members are veterans, and although none of us are looking forward to entering one of the cemeteries, one of the recognitions that the United States does offer is burial in a veteran's cemetery. It is our country's last chance to recognize the service of its soldier citizens. We have thousands of veterans of all services throughout our state. We only have cemeteries in Sitka and in Anchorage. On behalf of AARP, we encourage your committee to pass HB 45 and give all our veterans and their families the honor of a local cemetery. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Luby?
Thank you for your service. Thank you.
No questions. Thank you very much. We also have available Lisa Pusich. I hope I didn't mess the name up totally, with the Department of Administration in the finance section. Available for any questions or any of the comments or questions that have been out here so far that you would care to respond to, or no? Thank you. I have nobody else to testify. Representative Ledoux.
I wonder if Ms. Pusci might be able to articulate whether or not there's some state policy regarding the acceptance of gifts. Would that be within your purview?
I don't have any information on that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other persons in the audience wishing to be heard on this, on House Bill 45? Anybody else that we have online that signed in since? Okay. Seeing not, then I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 45. Is there a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to make a recommendation and not an official motion. I would like to see, because of the unanswered questions and because of the importance and the respect that I have for our veterans who have served, who are serving, and who will serve, those who have passed, I would like to see some answers to these questions so we can do this right. So whether you feel this is best sent to a subcommittee or we ask the sponsor to work with the DMVA and then bring this bill back, you know, before us, or if at that point it's determined we're not the appropriate committee, we, because I would like this done right.
Mr. I would be delighted to come back with the answers to the many questions.
Okay, let me go another round. General Campbell, please. If we were to refer this bill to your department for response on some of those criteria and guidelines that have been mentioned here, would this be something that you could accomplish in a reasonable time frame for us?
Mr. Chair, Jerry Beal from the Veterans Coordinating Office within my department has been working with his office, and I have no problems with continuing working. I'd ask, though, this is sponsored by a representative, and that the representative represent before you his bill. But I'm offering and suggesting it's appropriate that DMVA be the department that he would work with.
That's where I'm headed. So as sponsor of the bill, would you be willing to have us hold this bill so that you could then have a little bit more time to work with the department to make sure that all of the criteria that we're asking for clears up? Because I'm in agreement with what I've heard from the other committee members. We want to get this done right, not fast.
Mr. Chair, it would be my pleasure. I mean, the amendments that happened last year only made it stronger. And the comments that I've heard here, if not answered here, will be answered in the next committee. I'd be delighted to take care of business here before we move on.
That would be great. So unless there's an objection, I'm going to have this bill held over until such time as we have the answer to those questions. Is there any objection from any committee members?
Sir, not an objection, a comment. Are there, does this bill incorporate the amendments from last year? It already does. Thank you. Didn't know if there was anything that we could. Thank you.
Again, thank you very much, both of you, for that. And we will move on then to the next one that we have in front of us, which is House Bill, what number do I have? 62. Okay. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay, please state your name and your intent, please.
For the record, my name is Casey Schroeder-Hotch. I'm staff to Representative Thomas. And I believe that you have an amendment before you. Would you like to deal with that first, or would you like me to speak to the bill first?
No, speak to the bill first, please.
Okay. So the bill basically has three different parts, and I'll just walk you through the three parts as they show up in the bill. The first part grants National Guard members free hunting and fishing licenses, and this is an important recruiting tool, but it's also a way for the state to say thank you for the sacrifices that these men and women make every day for us. Many other states have similar programs, and this is just a continuation of programs like that. The second part of the bill gives 50% tuition waiver to spouses of Alaska National Guard members, and this is an important retainment tool because when it comes time for a Guard member to decide whether or not they're going to stay in the Guard, the spouse has a lot of say in whether or not they're going to stay. And if they're not getting anything or not seeing any benefit from being in the Guard, then usually their suggestion might be to leave. And it's also a way to thank the spouse for the tremendous sacrifice that they make. They're required to maintain the home front for long periods of time while their spouse is deployed. And basically, when a Guard member joins the Guard, so does their entire family. The ripple effect from that person's decision to join the Guard is tremendous. More than any other career choice, it has a tremendous effect on the family. And the third part deals with both the spouse tuition waiver and the current tuition waiver program that we have in place. Historically, there's been a problem fully funding this program for the Guard members, and when people join the Guard, one of the main reasons they join is to get an education, and there has been periods where people have been denied this because of lack of funding. So we want to get to the point where we're not turning away anybody because of lack of funding. So what the third section does is it directs the general to ask for a supplemental appropriation if he finds that he's short on funds for this program. So that's basically the bill.
Okay, well, I do have a question, and if you can answer it, fine. We also have other people either in the audience or online that may be able to answer the question when I recognize them later. But do you know whether or not involvement in this tuition program, if there's an administrative cost that the department has, and then when it does go to the university, is there another administrative cost that's handled at that point? Do you know?
I believe that the university... Representative, I believe the university submitted a zero fiscal note for that, and the DMVA should have submitted a fiscal note that have indicated their costs.
Okay, well then maybe I can ask General Campbell, would there, under this scenario, would there be some type of administrative cost that would be extracted from those dollars for the tuition grants that are available, or scholarships, whatever you want to call them?
Mr. Chairman, Craig Campbell, Commissioner of DMVA, and sir, we don't extract any administrative fees. There are costs of employment of state employees when you administer a program. This is a program that we encourage. We've always supported, and as was presented to you, there have been cases where we've actually run out of money, where people have wanted to use the program, and there was not money available. But that doesn't that means that the funding for the program is at issue. I believe that while the university has submitted a zero fiscal note, they still have a process cost to take students into the university, just like I have a process cost for running things in my department. It's not substantial from the DMVA perspective. That's why I don't have an administrative fee identified of a large number. That should not be the issue from the DMVA perspective.
Okay. Again, let me, as a follow-up question, since I have you at the mic, I know that one of the reasons that these scholarship programs were set up initially was as a recruitment measure for helping you to attract folks that are into the Guard, and also as an incentive for those that are in the Guard and a reward for those that have served. So would this be troublesome if we created another one that would allow spouses? I mean, could you see a scenario where if there's a certain number of dollars that were provided, one of the Guard members applies, a spouse applies, then the money's used up, and now you have a Guard member apply and there's no money left? I mean, is this something that typically is all the money expended that's available every year?
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to analyze your question, and I think what I'm hearing from the question is, in the funding way of doing business, if this were to pass, is there the possibility that you would have a soldier or an airman in the National Guard that could not get an education because there was not adequate funding available while maybe a spouse did or somebody else did?
That's correct.
If I heard the testimony right, I think that the testimony was that the correction to that would be a supplemental to the legislature. Just thinking off the top of my head, that seems like it may be problematic, because as I understand the process, you don't have to approve supplementals. I can submit all I want, but you could say no, in which case then there isn't funding necessarily for the Guard member. So structurally, only from what I just heard just in the last few minutes, it appears if you're tying a spouse program and a membership program together with a specific dollar figure on the expectation that if it's exceeded, you could use a supplemental, we may not be able to provide service to all that ask.
Okay. I think that answers my question.
Just what I heard today, sir.
Well, let me ask as a follow-up. Under the current program that you have, is it your opinion, and you may not be able to give me this because of the position that you're in, and if you can't, I will certainly respect that position. In your opinion, are the Guard members best served by having that money, since the university shows it as a zero fiscal note, and it looks like you have it down as a fiscal note? Would the Guards and the Guard members' families be better served if that money were funded through the through the university, or if the program was administered through the university simply by showing that they're qualified members of the Guard, or are you happy with it placed where it is?
Mr. Chairman, I think technically what you're asking me is a policy call that I'm not prepared to answer at this moment. I do support the program of having Guards members provided educational benefits by the state of Alaska, and I do support the program of trying to allow others who are spouse-specific of a Guard member to also participate to some level. I'm not prepared on a policy position to tell you how that should be structured at this moment.
I respect your answer. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for...
is this a question of Jonah Campbell or the sponsor?
Well, it's just for everyone's benefit.
Thank you.
In a previous meeting that we had that many folks were in this morning, DMVA Finance Subcommittee, we did talk about the approximately $60,000 a year that we... and that's an approximate number that we run short every year on funding, and that is for the Guard members to receive their education. And when that was brought up in the meeting this morning, it was with the intent of a commitment was made by myself that I am looking for $60,000. If I knew I had $60,000 of money that I could spend on anything out of this budget, I would commit it to this. It's that important to me. However, I we're aware that that we're short of funds. My personal thought is that we need to absolutely take care of the soldiers and those that enlist, and if we can do something for the spouses, I think that's wonderful, but that we absolutely need to take care of the other. And I think that by keeping it with the military member and then keeping it in DMVA, you're able to probably manage that without the university have to be involved in managing that. Now we start getting spouses, and even though it's a great thing, it does present a different management problem that, or opportunity, however you choose to look at it, that you brought up.
Let's see if we can, as a committee, can find our time to questions before we actually discuss the bill and have a debate on it, but I appreciate your comments. Any other questions from the committee members for the sponsor of the bill or for General Campbell, either one? Any other questions? Yes. Representative Book.
Point of clarification, I'm looking at this bill addressing not just spouses, but it's members of the family. Am I correct in what I'm reading, that this does address not only spouses, but members of the family? Or are we looking at the amendment?
This bill, as you said, addresses family members, but there is an amendment attached that spouses, so I think people have sort of jumped ahead, but...
Okay, I'm just trying to clarify what it is that we're dealing with right now.
Well, since we don't have a discussion of the bill on the table, we've just had a presentation of the bill. We're supposed to be asking questions, not discussing. So
I'm asking.
So you're half right. Any other questions at this point in time from the committee to either the sponsor or General Campbell? Okay, I'm going to go to Mary Gower from the University of Alaska. Is Mary here or is she online?
I'm online.
Okay. Would you please state your, did you have a comment you wanted to make, or were you just available for questions?
I'm available for any questions.
Okay, then I will start by asking the question that I asked earlier. Are there administrative fees or cost related to administration of these tuition waivers for the university?
There's no administrative fee that's extracted from the current program as it stands. Is there an administrative cost to it? There is a certain amount of processing that's done, but the university did attach a zero fiscal note to this. We are in support of this program.
Okay. Would the university be as supportive of this program if all of the transactions were held through the university and none of them were through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs?
You know, to be honest, that's something that I can't speak to myself. Similar to the question earlier, as far as being a policy statement, I can't speak to that one.
Okay, well, I tried. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the university be supportive of giving a very reduced tuition rate to those members and who might qualify if this bill were to pass?
Again, I can get some additional information on that, but I couldn't speak to that one myself. I'm sorry.
If you could get back to us on that, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Any other questions of Ms. Gower or for the sponsor of the bill or General Campbell before we... Seeing none, is there anyone else online that we've missed? No, there isn't. Okay, well, I'm going to close public testimony on this bill and open it up for any motions that may be in order.
I guess just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kawasaki.
It has two more referrals, and one of the further referrals is to the Finance Committee. I think the intent is there. The intent is good. I don't have any problems with it moving out of committee, just that Finance Committee be able to take up those with recommendations. And I see the point. I guess there probably is a cost available there, and if the university were really willing to do that, I think that's something we need to approach the university with.
Okay. Is there a motion on the table so we can discuss this bill? Representative Ledoux.
I move House Bill 62, version 25-LS0303/A.
Okay. Is there any objection to it moving out of committee?
What about the two amendments?
I know we do.
Then I'll object.
Okay, so you're objecting for discussion purposes. All right, go ahead.
I'd like to move, Amendment 1, which would be to delete in page 1, line 1, families, and insert the word spouses.
Okay.
And
you want to do the other one at the same time? Take it all as
no
part
objection.
Of one, please.
Sure, and Amendment 2, page 3, line 5, to delete the word or child.
Well, we'll just take it all as Amendment 1. It would just address both.
Thanks.
Any discussion? Any discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, then the amendment passes with no opposition. Now we're on to the main motion. Main motion is the bill before you as amended.
With individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Absolutely. Any further discussion? Any opposition? There's no opposition, then we're going to move the bill out of committee to the next committee. Seeing none, the bill has moved to the next committee for referral. And any other comments or questions from the committee? Any statements from the sponsor?
Thank you.
You look like you were dying to say that, so. Okay, well, I want to thank everybody on the committee, and I certainly want to thank the support staff that we have here, and in particular, my chief staff, Josh Appleby, for putting all the packages together and helping us move along smoothly, and my first chair of a committee in this legislature. So I want to thank you all, and do not leave until you've signed the docket, and this committee stands adjourned at 2:50. 2:48.